Hello, my name is Mike Diedrich, and this is the Veterans for Peace radio show broadcast on KODX 96.9 FM. This reading will provide some background to the book Southern Voices, Viet Dong and the National Liberation Front, published by the University Press of Kentucky in 2022. In June 2022, Mike McCormick filmed an interview with me and Professor Christoph Giebel, historian at the University of Washington. The interview was filmed at the University of Washington Bookstore, Seattle. The bookstore will provide copies of the book. I'm going to read the dedication to this book. And this work is dedicated to the hundreds of refugee villagers killed in American and Arvin airstrikes on May 7, 1968, in Futowa near Plantation Road, Cholon, next to the barracks for Company A, 519th MI Battalion. The dedication is also important, and this one is, "In war, truth is the first casualty. Aeschylus," and a quote from Thomas Ahearn from his book, Vietnam Reclassified. "It is clear now, although then obscured by American ideological perceptions, transitory GVN successes, and the communists' own weaknesses, that the Viet Cong succeeded by exploiting a social and economic legacy of the colonial period. Only a collapse of communist will to win could have altered this outcome, and that will never faltered. The North Vietnamese tanks rolling into Saigon on 30 April 1975 sealed a victory that the Southern insurgents had won more than a decade before." A Vietnam journey. The Vietnamese called it the American War. The American called it the Vietnam War. At the center of that war was the Tet Offensive of 1968, called Tet Mau Tan by the Vietnamese. Defining Battle of Tet was the attack on the American embassy. In Saigon, where 16 Viet Dong soldiers, Rangers Special Assault Forces, including a man named Ba Den, blew a 3-foot hole in the impregnable embassy wall, entered the compound, and engaged in a 6-hour firefight that left 13 attackers dead along with 5 U.S. soldiers. For Americans, the cataclysmic shock of the countrywide Tet attacks, and particularly the embassy attack, were a turning point in their support of the war, especially after the often repeated promise of the light at the end of the tunnel that predicted victory. In 1968, I was an interrogator, analyst, and linguist, part of Company A, 519th Military Intelligence Battalion, the 525th Military Intelligence Group. I worked out of a joint U.S.-Vietnamese prisoner of war compound called the Combined Military Interrogation Center, CIMIC, located in Cholon, Saigon, down a street called Plantation Road from Company A, near the Futowa racetrack. In February of 1968, while on night duty at CIMIC, I was assigned to interrogate a wounded POW, Ba Den, who was one of 3 survivors of the 16 attackers and a commander of the embassy attack. It was because of that meeting and of the significance of the Tet attacks, especially of the Saigon attacks, and in particular the attack on the U.S. embassy, that I returned to Vietnam in 2013 after an absence of 45 years. I wanted to see if Ba Den was still alive and meet this now famous soldier. I had some anxiety about returning to Vietnam, but that was soon relieved with my first experience with the look and feel of Saigon and my contact with the Vietnamese people. The first thing I did in the morning after my arrival was take a pedal-powered cyclo over to my old Company A 519th MI Battalion barracks and to our CMIC interrogation compound. At both locations, there was absolutely no evidence of the former U.S. military presence. Both locations had been completely engulfed with the urban growth of Saigon, going from a population of less than 2 million in 1968 to over 8 million in 2013. Traffic was heavy in the city with lots of motorcycles, but a huge change in tension from 1968, where our battalion motor pool exit sign read, "You're about to enter the most dangerous area of Vietnam, Saigon traffic." Our battalion had several casualties from that period, traffic accidents, grenades, small arms attacks on vehicles. Driving in traffic was almost often with one hand on the wheel and one hand on a rifle or pistol in the lap. Americans then were angry, impatient, stressed, fearful, and arrogant, trying to push their military vehicles through traffic with little or no regard for any Vietnamese rights or cultural differences. None of that now, with heavy traffic, but not chaotic. Few Americans and the feel of a city that's vibrant, dynamic, clean, and orderly in its own fashion. After Vietnam, I was active with Vietnam Veterans Against the War, serving as a regional coordinator of Washington State in 1971 to 72. Before this trip, I had the revelation that some VVAW old Winter Soldier newspapers and some VVAW patches and buttons, along with some Veterans and Peace literature, would be of interest and of interesting introduction to the War Remnants Museum, especially coming from a former American soldier. Before going over to the museum, I had the foresight to write out in Vietnamese a short bio introduction to the point as to the point of my visit. Here is the English translation. I am an American, and I was in Vietnam in 1967-68. I was an American sergeant. After I returned from Vietnam, I worked for peace. I was angry and sad about the war. I joined Vietnam Veterans Against the War. I have some newspapers of VVAW that I want to give the museum. I kept it simple. My Vietnamese was and is rusty after a lapse of 45 years. I went over to the museum, introduced myself to the staff there, showed them my intro in Vietnamese, and asked for a meeting. The two women I spoke to were very courteous and promised to get back to me. I gave them my hotel and room number. One of the women gave me the wai or the namaste gesture, hands clasped together in a slight bow. Not something Vietnamese commonly do, but a sign of respect, usually for elders. That would be me at 619, at 68 years, and was an acknowledgement that I was not expecting and was very touched. That evening, the secretary for the director, a woman speaking good English, called and said the director, Huynh Ngoc Van, also a woman, would see me tomorrow at 10 a.m. I arrived to the museum and was immediately shown inside a small conference room. A few minutes later, Mrs. Van came in with her English-speaking interpreter, although Van's English was very good. She graciously thanked me for coming, and I gave her a little bit more background on myself and VVAW VFP. When we were talking about the war, she said that the American soldiers were young and needed reconciliation. I gave her the VVAW newspapers and some buttons and patches from VVAW VFP. After signing multiple invoices, acknowledging receipt of the papers and buttons, Bond told me about the 40th anniversary of the Paris Peace Accords in 1973 and a special exhibition planned. Van asked me for some more biographical information on me and VFP VVAW, and wanted other artifacts, including posters that would illuminate the work of VVAW VFP. She said she would like to include this in some of their special 40th anniversary exhibition in March. And I promised I would send the biographical info and other material she would think useful. The staff photographer took pictures, including some with my camera. And Yvonne gave me a t-shirt, a cap, and some beautiful button, all with the museum logo, which is a picture of a white dove superimposed over bombs. She also gave me a copy of Speak Peace, a collection of American writers, including veterans, who wrote poetry inspired by Vietnamese children's paintings on war and peace. With it, she gave me a companion Coast Guards, which were printed in the book. The project was sponsored, in addition to the museum, by Soldier's Heart and the Witt Poetry Center at Kent State, a very powerful and moving collection. After my visit to the museum, I went over to the Boudium, the old central French-built post office, sat in the vaulted ornate lobby under the benevolent gaze of Uncle Ho, watched the tourists, and cooled down. I walked outside and was accosted by an older Vietnamese man, Le Van Te, who insisted on telling me about, in a surreal conversation in French, Vietnamese, and English, about his life and work with the French and American armies, and showed me his wallet of pictures. I told him of my time during the war. We gabbed for a half an hour or so, and he told me of another American, Michael, who spoke excellent Vietnamese and was often at the Boudium, taking pictures and hanging out. Our conversation ended. I walked away, but he came rolling over to me on his motorbike and pointed and said, "There is the Michael I was talking about." I walked over and Michael started talking to me in Vietnamese, and I quickly said in Vietnamese, "Tôi hiểu tiếng Việt, nhưng không khá lắm," which means I understand Vietnamese, but not very well. I switched to English, and Michael told me he had been living in Vietnam for 45 years, had an American Vietnamese wife, Vietnamese American wife, took photographs they'd used to work for the state-run oil gas corporation. I told him of my part in the war, in particular my interest in finding Ngo Van Nhan, also known as Ba Den, who I met as an analyst interrogator at CMIC. After our conversation and after exchanging email addresses, I returned to my hotel to find an email later that evening from Michael with several links, including a 2009 thesis presented by Major Robert O'Brien of the U.S. Army Command in General Staff College, Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, in partial fulfillment for his Master of Military Arts and Sciences. The thesis was on the 1968 attack on the U.S. Embassy, and one of Major O'Brien's citations in his bibliography was a CMIC report number U.S. 540-68 prepared by Specialist M.R. Diedrich, 12 March 1968, yours truly. That this information was on the web and public available was astounding to me, and that it was a 2003 classified report in the National Archives in Washington, D.C., on a former NLF POW Ba Den, whom I had come to Vietnam to search for. Michael also told his friend and co-worker, Nguyen Trong Hung, about my interest in Ba Den, and Hung, a member of the Communist Party, said he would investigate the whereabouts of Ba Den. Through his in-law, a retired former military provincial commander, Hung found out that Ba Den, having survived the embassy attack and years of imprisonment at the infamous prison at Con Dao, was killed in a traffic accident shortly after liberation in 1978. I traveled to Hanoi and I met Hung before leaving to Vietnam. I bought a bat hung, an incense holder used for graveside ceremonies, and asked Hung and Michael to take it to Ba Den's grave in a military cemetery to pay my respects. That simple and unpremeditated gesture on my part opened some doors that otherwise might have been difficult to open. Hung explained my story and project to some of the Viet Dong whom he now knew, and set up an email address to begin a correspondent introducing me to these old soldiers. I hope to find more information about the other Viet Dong embassy workers, to learn their stories without any filters. It was not to be another military history. Rather, I envision a book of personal remembrances published in English and Vietnamese. Finding these stories was complicated because of the self-imposed secrecy of the Viet Dong organization and the brutal facts of the war itself. Back in the States, my research led me to the National Archives, which had declassified CMIC and other reports after 2003, including my own reports on Ba Den and the other two survivors of the embassy attack. The records, however, were often cursory, mostly military in scope, with little personal information. This lack of personal information led me back to Vietnam, with the active encouragement of Michael Hung and my newfound female Vietnam contacts. When I returned to Vietnam in 2014, Hung arranged a meeting with the Saigon Ja Den Committee of Viet Dong. I met this group of six men in a small office on a Ho Chi Minh City military base. Their mission, as I understood it, was to keep track of past living Viet Dong soldiers, provide a living historical record of the Viet Dong, and to help with material support. After introductions, I explained through Hung that I wanted to find out more information on the embassy attackers, in addition to Ba Den. I confirmed the existence of two other attackers who survived with CMIC reports, which I gave to the committee. They were known as Nguyen Van Sao and Dan Van Song, and had disappeared into the infamous South Vietnamese prison system. Other than aliases and some family names, the rest of the 13 others slain in the attack were unknown. If Ba Den had been killed, he would have been as anonymous as his comrades. The secrecy of the Viet Dong was such that identities were known only to their senior commanders, if at all, and only by aliases. Fellow soldiers in a given unit were strangers to each other and were employed in specific one-time operations. This compartmentalization, when paired with the Saigon government's deliberate anonymous burials of dead VC, has left virtually no physical record of these soldiers. As I listened to the committee explain this, it became clear that writing about these dead ghosts was not realistic. How the committee did explain, however, that there were other living Viet Dong who were involved with the Tet attacks on the presidential palace, police headquarters, the radio station, the military assistance command, Vietnam headquarters at Tan Chin Air Base, among other targets. The committee offered me access to these former Rangers, and I agreed with the mutually understood provisions that any written material would be approved by the interviewees prior to publication. Hung and the committee said that it was to be my project with no censorship, the only requirement being that they receive copies of the published results. This access was given in part because of the respect I'd shown a year earlier in the gesture for Ba Den's grave, and the fact that I was a former interrogator, linguist, and American anti-war veteran who thought their personal stories were important. For me as a former enemy, the generous and comradely reception I received from these Viet Dong soldiers, NLF soldiers, was overwhelming and brought me very close to tears a couple of times. We conducted eight interviews, including three women and two senior commanders, one of whom was the commander of Pham Suen An, a former Time magazine Saigon bureau chief, and one of the most famous spies ever, certainly of the Vietnam War. Five of the soldiers were Viet Dong, and the other three were National Liberation Front, simply called Mat Tran Front by the Vietnamese resistance. Once I convinced the soldiers of my sincerity, they openly related their stories. Four people assisted me as translators, three Vietnamese, including Hung, his wife Zung, and their daughter Huang. along with Michael, an American who speaks fluent Vietnamese. These sessions produced about 15 hours of audio recordings. Narratives of these people are compelling because these recordings represent the first time that personal stories of Viet Dong history have been recorded in both languages. These general outline of these stories were familiar to me as a former combat soldier and interrogator, but for my translator collaborators, listening to certain details was traumatic and persuaded them of the importance of having this information, this historical record. Their narratives were all different, but common threads tied them together. One was their personal identification with the long history of Vietnamese resistance to former foreign aggression. In some families, this went back 100 or more years. Another was a sense of moral outrage over the often brutal repression and reprisals to peasant and student resistance by the government. Another was the careless and indifferent destruction of villages and their inhabitants by the Americans, along with the disrespect and ignorance shown to their culture. Several interviewees quoted Ho Chi Minh's famous remark, "Nothing is more precious than independence and liberty." My daily contact with prisoners, translators, and villagers and my language skills gave me an appreciation of Vietnamese society that most Americans did not have. I liked most of the Vietnamese and respected the prisoners I interrogated. I did not personally engage in torture and told my interviewees as much. At no time was I aware of any rancor or anger directed at me personally. In fact, some sympathy was voiced towards U.S. soldiers, especially draftees and Black Americans. Americans were admired for principles of freedom and technological superiority. Any criticism was usually about how the U.S. got involved in Vietnam, how the U.S. got involved in Vietnam in the first place, and the kill anything that mattered tactics they employed in the war. I took the 15 hours of audio home with me and composed a notice, which I posted on the Vietnam Scholars Group, VSG, website, moderated at the University of Washington. I outlined the background of the project, and since my Vietnamese language skills had lapsed after 45 years, asked for pro bono translation help. I did not have the resources to pay translators, yet a dozen or so Vietnamese responded. Many wrote that they felt it to be their patriotic duty to help. These sentiments from mostly younger Vietnamese students and academics echoed those of the Viet Dong as to why they had joined the resistance against the government and the Americans. One of my early responders to my VSG post was Lê Thị Thông, a Seattle-based Vietnamese woman who had professional experience translating and was fluent in English. She was and remains a invaluable asset in this effort, along with Dong, Hung's wife. On my return in Vietnam in 2017, Thuong was visiting relatives in Saigon, and her April visits overlapped by 2 days, allowing her to meet the Vietnam committee. The project process was to transcribe the audio into Vietnamese, translate that text into English. I edited the interviews into readable and smooth narratives. The narratives were then translated into Vietnamese, since the old purpose of the project had been to make a bilingual publication. I carried the Vietnamese narratives back to Vietnam, hoping with some trepidation that if, after so many back and forth with translation and editing, they would actually match what the Viet Dong told me. For the most part, the Viet Dong that I talked to on this trip said that that is what they said. There were a few corrections and additions. Since my previous trip, Nguyen Hu Loi, one of the Viet Dong, had died. I only talked with him a few hours. We had become friends immediately, partially because of our mutual respect, but perhaps more because of his outgoing and generous nature. He had given me a framed iconic mug shot of him and Nguyen Van Troy taken over when they were captured with their stack of TNT explosives on a table in front of him. Though not the oldest or youngest at 70, Larry had been associated with one of the most famous. He was captured along with his partner, Nguyen Van Troy, while attempting to blow up the bridge that Robert McNamara was traveling in May 1964. Troy took the blame for the attempted attack, and the government, in a tactical and strategic blunder, executed him a few months later. Troy became the first publicly executed and one of the most famous members of the Southern Resistance. For his heroism, he is awarded the Hero of the People's Armed Forces Award, an honor that was also given to Baudin. His execution was filmed, and he remained defiant to the end. His last words before his execution in Saigon to correspondents were, "You are journalists, and so you must be well informed about what is happening. It is the Americans who have committed aggression on our country. It is they who have been killing our people with planes and bombs. I have never acted against the will of my people. It is against the Americans that I have taken action." When a priest offered him absolution, he refused, saying, "I have committed no sin. It is the Americans who have sinned." As the first shots were fired, he called out, "Long live Vietnam." He was and is one of the most revered and honored soldiers of the Southern Resistance. Loy had been locked up at the infamous Con Dao prison, eventually spending 10 years there, enduring beatings and tortures and tiger cages until freed by the Paris Peace Accords in 1974. The oldest interviewees were Bai San and Thu Khan, 91 and 92 respectively, and both lucid enough to look at the narratives and correct them. Thu Khan, the more vigorous of the two, was particularly warm and welcoming. After the editing session, he gave me some more autographed books, and we eased out to the courtyard for goodbyes. He held my hand and gesture of friendship that surprised me and pleased me with its intimacy. Our visit to Bai San found him in a wheelchair, but alert enough to listen to the narratives and offer a few corrections. His repeated desire, as has several of the other Vietnamese, to know where their comrades killed in, he repeated his desire to know where his comrades killed in the Tet Offensive were buried. I attempted to honor their request. I contacted members of the U.S. military police that eventually took charge of the embassy after the attack, the mortuary unit at Tonsonyut Air Base, and a former South Vietnamese colonel present at the embassy of the attack. My inquiries stirred up some very tough memories for some of the military policemen who were the first units to respond to the attacks. The 716th MP Battalion was the first unit to respond to the Saigon Tet attacks, sustaining over 70 casualties, including several killed at the embassy. No one could provide definitive information. I understood the importance of honoring the dead in Vietnamese ancestor worship traditions, and was disappointed that I could not help them resolve this issue. Only the narratives of Le Hong Quan and Nguyen Duc Hoa required much editing or additional information. I actually met six of the eight people, and with Nguyen Hu Loi deceased, it only left Le Hong Quan unmet on this trip because she was attending her 101-year-old mother in Can Tho. She submitted some poetry to be included in her piece. Lei Hong Kong and her mother had both been imprisoned in Con Dao. Her mother, with the resistance since 1947, was resisted a few months after Quan was captured. An anecdote to this is when Lei Hong Kong was captured just before she had her arm basically shot in two, and on the arm was her, on the ring of an arm, was a ring her mother had given her, and she wanted to see if she could take the ring off before she was captured, but she said, finally just cut the arm off and let it go. This time, some of the interviewers were filmed by a photo crew of Vietnam TV One, which included a lengthy piece on me. My main interest was the anomaly of an American anti-war veteran who talked to one of their national heroes, Baudin. I paid another visit to the War Remnants Museum and was graciously received again. I wanted to give the museum the unedited audio files of the interviews for their archives. They thanked me and told me that they too had interviewed some NFL soldiers and recorded the memories of some women soldiers. The trip concluded with a visit to a safe house used by some of the Vietnam, including embassy attackers. I was warmly welcomed with genuine and emotional enthusiasm. Among the Vietnamese there to greet me was one of the sons of Ba Dinh, whose likeness to his father was astonishing, a virtual twin. Hung and his wife, Zung, generously treated Mike Abadai and his wife, Hung's visiting his relatives, and me to a dinner at the Hum Vegetarian Lounge in Saigon for some of the best vegetarian food I've ever eaten. I closed out the day before an early flight to Incheon and then to Seattle with a visit to the top deck of the Majestic Hotel, made famous by Graham Greene as his last stop in his daily constitutional down the Rue Katana, now called Dong Khoi. As a soldier occupied by the war and my duties, I did not have the time or money in 1968 to mingle with the journalists and generals that gathered nightly to watch the sunset in 1968. But on this trip in 2017, 1 year removed from the 50th anniversary of the Tet Offensive, I enjoyed the terrace of the Majestic as Green's protagonist Fowler did in The Quiet American with, quote, the cool wind from the Saigon River in my face. After my return from Vietnam, I was invited to present a paper at Texas Tech University for the 1968, called the 1968 and Tet Offensive in April 28, 2018, Lubbock, Texas. My paper was entitled NLF Viet Dong Narratives and Saigon Tet Attacks. I read from the narrative of Le Hong Quan, a woman soldier and poet who, despite having an arm shot off during a firefight, resisted capture until out of ammunition. The presentation was well received, especially among several Vietnamese in attendance. At the conference, I met several history professors, including Edwin Moise, who, after reading my presentation synopsis, suggested I send a proposal to the University of Kentucky Press. After acceptance for consideration, two press reviewers recommend publication. My personal proposal was approved and the contract signed. But a change in the editorial board reneged on the earlier agreement, citing an objection to publish the book in Vietnamese. I provided earlier emails indicating the intent and agreement to publish in English and Vietnamese. And a different board moved the project back to acceptance, with the editor saying they were proud to publish the work. It took 7 months to assemble and completed narratives in English and Vietnamese, finish the photographs and maps, provide a bibliography, glossary, and foreword. The press provided an editor for the English text. I was lucky to also have the editing available from academia editorial professional staff that included former professor of Vietnamese history and Lady Borden, a published author fluent in Vietnamese. These editors, along with my Vietnamese translator who edited the corrected Vietnamese text, gave the project its necessary vetting. After months of assembly and editing, I got a late by-the-way note from the press. Do you have a permission for the photograph used to the cover of the book? The image, which is of a Vietnamese young woman, NLF porter, carrying a box of ammunition, was from what I thought was an open internet source. Press insisted on a citation for the image. To get provenance for the press, I turned to my Vietnamese colleague who contacted the Vietnamese Army Archives, who identified the picture, location, and photographer, but not the name of the woman. The archives, knowing of the context, readily gave permission to use the image. The many months and years from acceptance by the University of Kentucky Press and compilation by me finally resulted with the publication of Southern Voices, Viet Dong and the National Liberation Front in May 2022. In January 2023, after successful book readings at the University Bookstore and Elliott Bay Bookstore in Seattle, and favorable book reviews on Amazon, took 19 books back to Vietnam to give my now Viet Dong comrades and colleagues. It had been 10 years since I first returned to Vietnam and embarked on this project. For the Viet Dong and their friends, my return to Vietnam with a book of their stories was an occasion for celebration and thanks, that at times almost overwhelming me with their gratitude. I visited two Viet Dongs because of their age and disability. The first was Lê Hồng Quân and her home, a modest one-story building. Lê Hồng Quân greeted us in her small parlor, and we sat at a table with water bottles and books. Finn's son, who spoke passable English, translated. Lê Hồng Quân greeted me warmly and thanked me several times for the autographed copy of the book I gave her. She also gave us several copies of her autographed books. After 15 minutes of conversation, she was clearly fading in strength and had to be helped to her bedroom to lie down. The years and debilitations of war and prison had marked her. It was sad to see her once smiling and strong face so marked by pain and fatigue. My other visit was with Duc Cang, at 93, the oldest of the Viet Dong. Hung and I sat at the same table as our first visit, and I gave him my book. After his thanks, he gave me his new signed biography. He remarked it was lucky to have interviewed him because of his age. He was tiring, and as he left my house, he again grasped my hand in friendship. I felt grateful that I had met him, but I was sad knowing that would be the last time I saw him. During my 10-day visit, I was interviewed and filmed by five separate filmmaker reporters, including Phuong Lan, her daughter Binh, Mrs. Hung, and Luan, including TV Vietnam. One interviewer gave me a very nice Parker pen, another a fine wicker basket made from lily pads, a national symbol in Vietnamese. Interspersed with these filming sessions were gratis car rides to dinners and lunches. At the center of this organized whirlwind was Hung and Zung, the couple that I first met 10 years ago, and who facilitated my meeting with the Viet Dong and translated many of the interviews. Mr. Binh, whose father was a Viet Dong, was also very generous with the transportation and food. The heart of the reunion was this meeting with the surviving Viet Dong and their relatives at their new club. Hu Loi had died 2 years ago, and Bay Son, who was hospitalized when I was arrived, died during the visit. Two other Viet Dong were in hospital, and one Muay Tan, although in a wheelchair, was in attendance with his wife. The Viet Dong had moved from their original location on a small military base in the city to its present location, a few rooms upstairs in an old gray two-story concrete building with a rare elevator, a useful amenity for aging Viet Dong. After picking me up at my hotel, with Hung driving and Zung navigating, we threaded our way through the city, still a mix of older one and two story buildings and modern glass and steel, modern constructions that would not be out of place in any Western city. Hung dropped us off and we walked in to squeeze into the creaky elevator bearing us to the second floor. Upstairs was dark with only windows on the street side admitting much light. By the time Hung returned from parking, the room was cozy crowded with Zung, Michael Abadi, Muay Tan in a wheelchair with his wife and several other Viet Dong, including a hail Miss Bích Na and Nguyen Duc Hoa, relatives and supporters of the deceased. It was good to see some Viet Dong left standing in good health. It made me feel lucky how I was able to have met and meet these old soldiers whose stories would have remained unknown, surely at least to American readers. Mr. Hung, who was with her photographer husband, acted as MC. The gathering was extensively covered by photographs and videos. The meeting was a reunion of survivors, families, and supporters. And it was a luck lucky that I brought as many books as I did, a dozen or so, as I gave them all away, holding only one out to give Suan Phuong, a gallery owner I had met on an earlier trip. There were multiple greetings to meet with posing for photographs and filming. As after each presentation and thanks, I was prompted by Zung to stand up and with her translating, give a short speech acknowledging and thanking them for their kind words. After a dozen, half dozen stand-up speeches, I started to repeat myself, but my polite hosts took no notice. In addition to the many lunches and dinners, my friends Hung and Zung included me for a gala night at the French-built 19th-century opera house. It was to be a two-hour program of patriotic song, including Vietnamese culture. In addition to the songs, there were pictures of art that provided a backup to the singers. All very hyper-patriotic, as I thought initially. But then I recalled 4th of July and Memorial Day's pageantries in the U.S., and they seemed quite familiar. The women were quite stunning in their beautiful alyais. After Zung introduced me for pictures with the military commander, and after Zung introduced me for pictures with the military commander of the city, he was quite gracious and patient with the interminable picture taking. My last visit was a meeting with Soan Phuong, which almost never happened, as she was headed out to the country for Tet's celebrations with her family. I met this 93-year-old woman upstairs in her galley. It was a short visit, but I was able to give her the last copy of Southern Voices, for which she was excited and grateful. She gave me books, including her recent memoir, Gun Gun, Go Kong, Kong Kong, which received a Vietnam Writers Award in 2020. About my book, she said, "Vietnamese want to read this book. I will see some contacts to help with promoting your book." Phuong gave me a lift back to my hotel, driven by her driver, who was driven for her for 30 years. The trip ended with an early morning ride from Mr. Bin, who used his judicial credentials to jump the check-in line in customs. We sat in VIP chairs awaiting boarding, and when time came, he grabbed my hand with his two hands for a warm farewell and thanks. As a last piece, I'd like to read the introduction written by Crystal Keyboard. Or actually, forward. Written by Christoph Gebel, professor of history at the University of Washington. Born of the author's desire to find answers to lingering questions from wartime service, and its scope greatly enhanced by a chance encounter in front of the old Saigon book, post office, this book on the Viet Dong is nothing less than a revelation. The interviews with surviving former Viet Dong members that Mike Diedrich has conducted are chock full of important insights and fascinating details that significantly contribute to our understanding of Southern Vietnamese revolutionaries. To this day, and with only a few notable exceptions, the fields of Vietnam studies and Vietnam War studies are largely lacking serious engagement with the Southern resistance. This is all the more surprising since Southern revolutionary nationalists provided the background to the nearly two decades-long struggle waged by the communists and their allies. Indeed, without them, the only victory of Vietnamese revolutionary nationalism would have been impossible. Yet after 1975, historical accounts have systematically marginalized the NLF and its Southern loyalists. They inconveniently stood in the way of simplistic U.S. and anti-communist Vietnamese narratives of a binary conflict, putatively between discrete political entities labeled North Vietnam and South Vietnam, while also threatening to weaken the North-centric triumphant claim of the Vietnamese Communist PCP. Southern Voices will help correct this long imbalanced historical record. In these interviews, ably translated into English, the reader will learn intriguing details about the Viet Dong organization, the structure, and extreme secrecy and compartmentalization in their operational duality of carefully foundation planning and rapid ad hoc deployment. The recollections contain glimpses of sheer courage and mentality of sacrifice among Vietnam members. Their revolutionary nationalist motivations and their biographical and familial roots and long established anti-colonial, anti-imperialist, and social revolutionary networks in South Vietnamese society, particularly outside urban upper-class milieus. And additionally, the number of female Viet Dong is surprisingly will contribute to historical analysis of the war that are more receptive to questions of gender. Along the way, the reader will also learn of the very dramatic fashion about historical events, not the least being the offensive Tet Mau Tan and the mistreatment suffered by surviving Viet Dong in captivity. Beyond these aspects that a foreword can only selectively highlight, there is much more in this book that readers with serious interest in the Vietnam or modern military history, particularly asymmetrical warfare, will find fascinating and illuminating. The last thing I want to read is a short biography of Ba Dien. The defining moment of the American war in Vietnam was the 1968 Tet Offensive and the attack on Viet Dong commanders on the U.S. Embassy in Saigon. Ba Dien was one of the leaders of that raid. Out of an assault force of 16, only he and two others survived. Ba Dien was named Ngo Van Nhang by his grandparents. Like most Vietnamese resistance fighters, he had several names. His grave in the Ho Chi Minh Martyrs Cemetery in Saigon carries the name of Ngo Thanh Van, his party biography, which lists his birth name as Ngo Van Van, notes and alias Nguyen Van Dong. Born in 1925 in the Red River Delta in the village of Hoa Luong, Thuong Tin District, Hay Tinh Province, about 50 kilometers southwest of Hanoi, Ba Dien spent his first 18 years in his hometown and worked as a blacksmith before moving south to Saigon with his mother, Ngo Thi Yen, his aunts and his brothers Ngo Phan Lung and Ngo Van Hiep. His father Ngo Van Chu had committed suicide in despair over the family's extreme poverty. In Saigon, Ba Dien joined the Vanguard Youth Organization, part of the Southern Viet Minh, and in 1948 became a party member. Shortly after arriving in Saigon, Ba Dien married Bui Thi Nam, and they raised six children: Ngo Thi Sam, Ngo Viet Hung, Ngo Thi Nhung, Ngo Viet Dung, Ngo Quoc Thanh, and Ngo Viet Tha. Ba Dien, his wife, and all six of his children served in the resistance. His daughter, Ngo Thi Nhung, was killed in American airstrike in Cu Chi. According to Ngo Thi Sam and Ngo Viet Tha, were interviewed for this biography, their father's motivation for rejoining the resistance developed from his patriotism and opposition to foreign invaders. Described as short-tempered and determined by his children, Ba Dien was imprisoned twice in Chi Hoa Prison from 1951 to 1954 and from 1958 to 1960. He later served as the Commissioner, Secretary, and Commander of Special Operations. In 1963, as Commander of Unit 159, under the operational control of F-100, he organized the February 1964 on the Kindo Movie Theater, which killed several Americans. In the aftermath of the embassy attack, Ba Dien wondered why, quote, heaven left him alive. After liberation in an article, Ma Tan Saigon, Ba Dien confided, "I have not forgotten the bloody images of the U.S. embassy battle. I remember every face, every word. I think of those generals who commanded tens of thousands of troops while sacrificing many. We cannot know what was in the hearts of these comrades." Ba Dien spent 5 years in prison in Phu Quoc Prison. like many of his prisoners, he left the prison emaciated and barely able to walk. He was sent north to recuperate in 1973 and returned south in January 1975. He worked as a captain of the 316th Regiment in Saigon. In 1975, he remarried, much to the disapproval of his children. And in a cruel irony, after surviving the war in prison, died in a traffic accident on the Wai Bridge in Cholon, Saigon. He was driving a Honda 67 motorcycle, and the other driver, a Joel soldier fresh from the jungle, turned and slammed into him. Ba Den was respected and admired by his comrades, and today remains one of the more celebrated heroes of the Southern Resistance. That is the broadcast for today. And again, this is broadcast on KODX 96.9. My name is Mike Diedrich, and I just gave a reading from the book Southern Voices, Vietnam and the National Liberation Front. This broadcast is also going to be archived on Veterans for Peace, VFP92.org. Thank you.